From WXXI News, this is Healthy Friday. I'm your host, Elisa Orlando. Thanks for joining us today. This hour, we're going to focus on one of the most hotly debated issues in healthcare. It's medical marijuana, and we are pleased to be producing this hour in association with the National Public Television show Second Opinion. Some of you are listening to us on the radio in Rochester, New York, and in Geneva, New York, or on the web. Second Opinion is produced by WXXI Public Broadcasting and the University of Rochester Medical Center in Rochester, and today's broadcast is part of the Second Opinion Live webcast series. So here's how you can participate. You can watch us live on a webcast at secondopinion-tv.org. You can also participate in today's conversation by calling us at 844-295-TALK. Or you can tweet your questions to this hashtag, 2NDOP. I have the computer here up with Twitter, and we can answer your questions. I'll get your questions to Dr. Timothy Quill that way. Our guest today is Dr. Timothy Quill. You've already met him if you've been watching us live on the web. If you're listening on the radio, I can tell you that Dr. Quill is professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities in the palliative care division in the Department of Medicine at University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Quill will be answering your questions throughout the hour, so we welcome your calls and your tweets. And a special thanks to the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. It's through their generous support that we can provide you with timely, accurate, and valuable health care information. And thank you so much to our public TV and radio supporters who help us make shows like this possible. So let's get started. Dr. Quill, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure.
In 1972, the U.S. Congress placed marijuana in Schedule I of the Controlled Substances Act because they considered it to have, in quotes, no accepted medical use. And since then, 23 of 50 U.S. states and Washington, D.C. have legalized the medical use of marijuana. So I'd like to delve a little bit more deeply into the context of these terms that are so used in the media coverage. We tend to blur or forget their meaning sometimes. What exactly is medical marijuana? It's a little bit more ambiguous or maybe more specific than we might understand it. What do we mean when we say medical marijuana?
Well, there's several different kinds or forms of medical marijuana. There is synthetic marijuana, which has been actually available legally by prescription for quite a period of time. And then there is other marijuana, usually coming from plants, that it can be taken in a variety of ways that has been illegal since the early 70s, but that whole legality process is changing kind of rapidly right now.
All right. We hear, we talk about the form, we're talking about the forms of marijuana. I hear in my reading and as I listen to and watch different forms of coverage, I hear this term cannabinoids. Am I saying that correctly?
Correct,
can you tell us what those are? There are three of them, correct?
There are three of them. There's actually about 100 of them.
Okay.
So there's a huge variation in the actual chemicals that go into that. Three main categories. But when you look at what's actually in any given plant, it can vary in a major way. This is one of the real challenges of thinking about medical practice, because we are extremely precise about the contents of other medications. So this is a very different kind of animal than we are usually confronted with.
All right. Can you explain what the chemical properties are? I think that what is it about marijuana that would make us able to use it medically?
Well, it has some effects on the central nervous system. There are some other effects on the nervous system as well, but mainly on the central nervous system that tend to get at receptors that control nausea, vomiting centers, maybe appetite centers. There may also be some well-being centers that people will variably respond to. So there's a lot of different effects in the brain, not all of which are really known.
So you talked about receptors. So it sends signals? Is it, I don't mean to oversimplify, but do we think of it like we might think of an endorphin?
It's probably not an endorphin. It might affect the endorphin system. The endorphin system would be the pleasure or pain system of transmitters. But it's gets into the central nervous system and can affect those kinds of receptors. The way it gets in, again, it gets into the bloodstream. If you take it orally, it can get in through the gastrointestinal tract, but its absorption is very variable. It goes through the liver if it's taken orally, so it's very hard to control the dose. Usually it's inhaled in one form or another as well, and again, the dose is a little quicker acting in those circumstances. But again, a lot of times when you get right down to it, you don't really know what's the exact chemicals that are in what is being inhaled.
All right, before we went on the air on the radio, we talked about the amazing rate of change with which our country has dealt with medical marijuana. Would you mind, for the benefit of our radio listeners, talk about that? You say it's really unreal to think of how quickly we've turned from thinking of marijuana as something illegal to legal. Describe what you were saying to me again.
Yeah,
please.
Well, I think I would say 10 years ago there was not a lot of action here, and then a couple of states legalized it in a very limited way, and then in the last couple of years, several states have completely legalized it, so it's not really medical anymore. It doesn't require a doctor's involvement.
Right.
And now I think 23 or 24 states have some form of legalization. Now, again, it's not consistent, the format. The requirements are not consistent. The prescribing practices are not consistent. So it's a tremendous amount of variation between states.
And that, and according to you, and you sort of echoed what I was saying, which is that it's happened really quickly.
Very quickly. I mean, social change terms, very, very quickly. These are, and more states are coming on the bandwagon, including New York State, where I live. We live has just come on. At least in theory, they've passed a law. The actual details of that law are still going to be worked out over the next year and a half. But we're right on the verge of some form of legalization here.
And University of Rochester Medical Center and Rochester might be involved in that in terms of what's happening in New York State. Describe what you're doing. We have applied to be sort of a test site. How does that work?
So there are going to be, I guess, four distributing centers, and each of those distributing centers will have five places that they distribute to. So there'll be a total of 20 places across the state that will be able to fill prescriptions for medical marijuana. They're going to really make an effort to distribute this geographically so that folks in all parts of the state will have some access to it. And the University of Rochester is going to be one of those centers.
All right, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. We're talking with Dr. Timothy Quill today. We're talking about medical marijuana. You might be watching us on the Second Opinion website, but you can also call in. We have an 800 number. It's 844-295-TALK, 295-8255. We're talking about medical marijuana. What's next for medical marijuana and exactly what it means in medical terms. We're going to try and clarify some terms in just a moment. You can also tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP on Twitter, and we'll be glad to put those questions to Dr. Quill and have them answer, or you can also make a comment there. It's the hashtag 2NDOP related to Second Opinion. So, Dr. Quill, you talked about receptors and about exactly what the medical properties of marijuana are. This is where we hear acronyms like THC and CBD. Can you describe what these are, what they mean? Some of them are related to pain, some related to nausea. Can you get into that for us?
It's probably even outside of my envelope, frankly. there are central CB1 receptors there, which have to do with pain receptors. There are also some peripheral CB1 and CB2 receptors. There are many different kinds of receptors that medical marijuana might potentially affect. And then again, there are several different chemicals, types of chemicals, categories of chemicals, and within each of those categories, there are a number of variants. So again, you're really looking at a huge variation in actual chemical compounds that are being used.
So there are two FDA-approved drugs in pill form, correct? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one way to get the drug into your system. That's what you described already. And then we hear eating it, vaporizing it, smoking it. And New York State passed the Compassionate Care Act. So that does not allow the smoking of marijuana. Is that how we understand?
That's correct. And the synthetic marijuana, Marinol and Sesamet are the two forms, have been around for a long time, and in fact, they don't get a lot of use, frankly. I mean, we prescribe them usually for nausea, for weight loss. They're not all that effective, so that people try them. Sometimes they want to go on to them. They can legally if you have a serious illness, but very few people actually stay on it, and it's partly because it doesn't have a lot of the euphoric effects of that marijuana has. So it separates out some of the appetite parts of marijuana from the euphoric side.
So you can use marijuana and not get high. Is that what you're saying?
Pretty much, yeah. With the synthetic marijuana, yeah. Some people are very sensitive to the high part, so they wouldn't be able to take this either because it would be too much for them. But a lot of folks can take that without a great deal of getting high.
All right. And I know that that there are diseases or conditions where there's evidence to support the use of marijuana. So what are those diseases or conditions?
So first of all, let me say that the evidence is very thin because the federal prohibition against which had marijuana as Schedule I really prohibited experimentation with humans because it was in a category that is high risk and no accepted medical use. So at the rescheduling, one of the good things that will come out of that is that we will be able to do some research to try to determine really which conditions can really benefit from that. So that is the one really brightest spot in this process of legalization, in my opinion. But the conditions that marijuana has been studied to some degree include glaucoma, HIV, AIDS, chronic pain, multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, and several other conditions. Those are the most common ones.
All right, and we heard, especially in New York State, the story of a family whose daughter had epilepsy and said that it really helped with seizures. So is it pain, nausea, seizure issues? Are those the kinds of things that it will address?
Yes, we think. Again, the research gets pretty thin, but I think those are the kinds of things, sleep disturbance, sometimes neuropathic pain in particular, spasticity sometimes with multiple sclerosis, seizures in some cases.
All right, that actually brings up a tweet that we just received, the hashtag 2NDOP. It stands for Second Opinion. 2NDOP is the hashtag on Twitter. This comes from Pittsburgh Dad, is the name of the person who's tweeting. Legal status aside, what's the current state of research on efficacy for marijuana for medical purposes? And you're saying it's pretty thin. Do you know what's out there? What have you seen?
There is not a lot of research on humans on medical marijuana, because it frankly has been completely prohibited in the past. Again, that is one of the good outcomes of legalization and scheduling it as a medication that has use but risk, which I think is the accurate scheduling of it. But then it allows you to study, do the benefits outweigh the risks and then in what conditions. One of the very difficult parts of studying marijuana is this diversity of what the actual chemical is between plants, between delivery systems, so that doing the kinds of precise studies that we're used to doing, this is going to require a different kind of research, I think.
And that was addressed in a program on WXXI recently at Connections with Evan Dawson, where what will happen with research, how can good research be done? It seems like right now most of the plants that are grown in a very specific way. And how will actual good research be able to come out of even this?
Well, I think we're going to have to rethink what good research is going to be. Are we really going to believe that we can blind both the researcher and the recipients that they are receiving marijuana and have them smoke something else or inhale something else? I think in pill form it's a little easier to think about some more meaningful controlled studies, because we do know that the placebo effect, if you get a sugar pill instead of an active pill in other kinds of studies, is actually pretty effective. So the mind has a tremendous ability to generate endorphins and things that make people feel better. So in that sense, for swallowed marijuana in a pill form, then you can imagine some that being a relatively easy area to do some studies. When you get to smoking marijuana and vaporizing it, I think it's a little harder.
All right, we have Dr. Timothy Quill in the studio with us right now. He's the professor of medicine and medical humanities, also psychiatry and palliative care division at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Our telephone number, if you'd like to call us, is toll-free at 844-295-8255. And we're also taking questions from Twitter at the hashtag 2NDOP. We have a question from our Twitter feed right now about PTSD. This person says, can we get an opinion on medical marijuana treatment for PTSD specifically related to trauma? How do you feel about that?
It's on the list that people are considering marijuana treatment. Again, very complex clinical situation where you know, the patients are very diverse, the kinds of conditions, the kind of trauma that they've been subjected to. And I think it in my mind, this would be a good example where some patients might benefit, but some patients might also really be harmed by this because of the, you know, euphoria that comes with that, the sort of disinhibition, the lack of inhibition that might come. For some PTSD patients might be very challenging. So I think that would be an area of high risk, maybe gain situation that you'd really want to have study about.
All right, and another question from Twitter. Dr. Quill, what do you think are the biggest obstacles for doctors when it comes to prescribing medical marijuana? What do you see as obstacles?
Well, usually doctors try to be really precise about tailoring the particular treatment to the particular disease. We like to go on evidence-based medicine whenever possible. Here we're going to be prescribing based on extremely thin evidence, based on patient demand and also a social phenomenon. So I think it's a really challenging area to think about how to prescribe in some professional, you know, rigorous way.
You sound a little skeptical, and it surprises me to hear you say that we're going to be prescribing based on patient demand. That's not what my doctor is going to do, is it?
Well, I don't see the basis really very based on evidence, which is how we try to recommend things. I don't see the basis for recommending people use marijuana. I suppose I can envision some circumstances. For example, in my field of palliative care, when we take care of people who are really sick, perhaps with very severe symptoms, and we've tried the usual treatments that are evidence-based, they aren't working very well, and the symptoms are still really bothering, then to me that's a little clear. If they wanted to try medical marijuana, it might work. We try a lot of other things that might work, and if it works, great. If it doesn't, then we've tried something else. I think the more you get away from that population to the general population, I think you're talking about throwing a significant chemical into people's lives, and I think driving that by a doctor's recommendation based on no evidence, I think, is pretty tough.
All right, that brings up a question that Bud may have, or related to a question that Bud may have. Bud's on line one right now. He's on the telephone. He wants to know about health risks. Bud, are you there?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Actually, I've got 2 points to make. First of all, I'm really excited by the receptor knowledge that's coming up. And I, if you're not aware of it, Arena Pharmaceuticals now has started a stage one clinical test on a cannabinoid agonist that would not have the side effects of opioid drugs, but would relieve pain. And that is going to be really fantastic when it comes out. But the question I have is this. People who are advocating for free recreational use of marijuana say that there's never been a death associated with marijuana, that is, the direct effects of marijuana. Do you know of any, and what is the mechanism that these people died if that happened?
Okay, thanks for the question, Bud. Dr. Quill?
Well, have there been any deaths associated with medical marijuana? Probably not directly associated with, but I think if you take, for example, one of the concerns many people have who write about this is, what about people with severe mental illness who might be struggling to stay alive, and they take medical marijuana and it uninhibits them? You know, and again, I think that there is a real risk in that population of suicide, of other forms of uninhibited behavior. So I think we ought to go into this with our eyes open that it's not without risk. It's probably not the direct effect of marijuana. Just a note of caution about phase one trials. Also, phase one trials are just, from a technical point of view, are to make sure the drug doesn't really hurt people. It's not a study of whether it works or doesn't work. It's not a controlled trial. It's just trying to get can people tolerate this. So it's between that and getting into real proven efficacy. There are many steps. It's one of the real challenges in this area.
All right, let's stay with the telephones now. Our phone number is 844-295-8255. 295-TALK. We're talking about medical marijuana today with Dr. Timothy Quill. Let's take this call from Michael. Thanks for waiting, Michael.
Hey, it's Mitchell. I'm sorry.
Mitchell, forgive me.
It's okay. Good afternoon, Dr. Quill. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks. Yourself?
Pretty good. Thank you. It's a really interesting topic, and as far as economical impact, I'm sure that it would benefit it. You know, just looking at how Colorado has benefited from the legalization of it recreationally and medicinally. But I wanted to know if you felt what you felt research, opening up the research aspect of it. Do you feel like more positive implications based on your understanding would show, or do you feel like it would kind of result in both pro and con, kind of?
My belief is that there will be benefits for sure for some patients. I think there will be serious risks for other patients, and I think that, like any other drug. So I think that will be found, but I'm totally in favor of research on this because there are people who probably will benefit. I think the more we learn about it, the more we can go into this with our eyes a little bit more open and less based on the romance of the latest thing on the block in a certain way, the better off we're going to be.
Now, California was the first state to legalize medical marijuana. That was back in 1996. Maybe not technically research, but what do you think that we learned with that? Doctors were besieged back then, too, with people trying to get it. Did we learn anything from it?
Well, I'm not sure how much it opened the door to a lot of research at that point. You know, I think there's been a little bit more. I think you learned that if you legalize it, people will use it. And anecdotally, if you walk along any beach in California, you will find marijuana smell. So it's there. It's very prevalent. There are shops all over the place. So I think it says that people will use it. There hasn't been a huge deluge of harm that anybody's shown as well. So I think it says that the jury's probably still out.
All right. Can we talk a little bit about dependence or addiction? It always comes up in this context. I saw one statistics from the UK that claimed there's not a lot of evidence to show that marijuana is addictive. At the same time, that same physician from Oxford claimed that as many as 10% of people who use it can lead to psychological dependence. I don't know how good this article is, that there's a risk of addiction, but it's very different than cigarette smokers. How do you feel about the discussion of addiction in this context?
Well, I think it's the crux of one of the real risks of this. If you take a look at the incidence of alcoholism in the general population, 10% lifetime, the incidence of drug abuse, general population, 10% lifetime, the incidence of poverty in the general population, 10 or 15%. So that there's about 30% of the population that have risk factors for this kind of prescribing. So again, if you've had those kinds of risk factors, let's say you've recovered from alcoholism and you're not drinking at all, the notion you're going to be able to then recreationally smoke marijuana without becoming addicted to that, I think most addictionologists would say that's extremely unlikely. It's possible, extremely unlikely. Similarly, if you've had a serious drug addiction problem and you've become abstinent, the notion you're going to be able to smoke recreationally, I think it's extremely unlikely. And then thirdly, for people who are very poor, if you can get medical marijuana, you may be able to put food on your table by selling that to other people. So again, there are a lot of issues that we don't like to talk about that I think really confound this discussion.
All right, our phone number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-TALK. If you have questions, we're also on Twitter. You can tweet your questions or your comments to our hashtag 2NDOP. I'm Elisa Orlando, and this is Healthy Friday, which is being produced in association with the national public television show Second Opinion. Today's broadcast is part of the Second Opinion Live webcast series, and our guest in studio today is Dr. Timothy Quill. A special thanks to the sponsor of Second Opinion, Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. Their support helps make Second Opinion Live possible. I'll be monitoring our Twitter feed during the break and during the show, and we'll get your questions to Dr. Quill. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back right after this.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, Roland Williams joins me for the first hour. The former NFL player and Rochester native is working his best to help kids in the area, but he says they are in desperate need of help, and he'll explain. Then it's our first Musicians Roundtable. What local bands are on the cusp of making it, and what hurdles are in front of artists as they try to succeed in music? That's Monday on Connections.
It was 50 years ago that Rochester was rocked by 3 days of riots that erupted in two predominantly African-American neighborhoods. A number of factors contributed to the violence, including jobs, housing, and alleged police brutality. Starting Monday, WXXI News will start a five-part series called Lessons from July 64, as we look back and, more importantly, evaluate how these issues are still affecting city residents. Listen each weekday at 6:35 and 8:35 a.m. and 5:45 p.m. on WXXI.
Welcome back to Healthy Friday on WXXI and on WEOS, or perhaps you're watching us during our Second Opinion Live webcast. You can see the webcast on www.secondopinion-tv.org. We also have our Twitter feed going for this Second Opinion Live webcast. You can tweet your questions to 2NDOP, the hashtag 2NDOP. Dr. Timothy Quill's in studio with us today, and we're talking about the issue of medical marijuana, especially from a medical and a health perspective. I know, Dr. Quill, that some doctors feel the list of diseases and conditions that medical marijuana is approved from is getting to be a little bit too long. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's very difficult. Usually when we use a medication, we'd like to come up with a unifying mechanism that that medication is working. With the range of illnesses that this is allegedly able to treat or help symptomatically relieve, it's a little hard to come up with a unifying mechanism. So I do think it's a long list. The studies really vary in how good they are in terms of how strongly we can really believe that it really helps.
All right, our phone number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. That is a toll-free number. I won't say you sound skeptical, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Do you think there's any harm in using marijuana for the approved conditions? Are there brain development issues other than the ones we've talked about, carcinogen issues?
I'm going to qualify this.
It sounds like you have to qualify everything you say in this discussion.
Well, you do because you can try to simplify a complicated issue, but this one's really complicated. So I think if you are a young kid, if you have a serious alcohol problems, if you have had serious drug addiction problems, I think medical marijuana is very risky. Okay, and I do think there are data, it's not the strongest data in the world, that kids that smoke a lot have diminished achievement. There is some suggestion that their brain development may be affected. I think that's a risk that I would not want to take with my kids or, you know, myself at all. And I do think, if you think about it, if you're in the group that smokes a lot, having your brain under the influence from an early age of a lot of marijuana, it's hard to believe that's not going to have some effect in terms of cognitive development. And so I think those really worry me. Now, people who use it infrequently, recreationally, that kind of thing, to me, that's not – it's me. This is me speaking as an individual. I don't see a lot of risk to that. Adults who are using it infrequently, recreationally. I do think there are issues around driving. We've gotten clear as a culture that driving under the influence of alcohol is a bad idea. But what about under the influence of marijuana? How many folks are out there driving under the influence of a little or a lot of marijuana? I think these are really fairly serious issues.
All right, let's take a phone call now. Jane's on the line. Thanks for holding on through the break, Jane. We appreciate it. Go right ahead with your question.
Sure. I thought we were only discussing marijuana for medical purposes. Is that correct?
We're certainly trying to keep the focus there, and
right.
I think that one of the things that Dr. Quill's pointed out is it's very hard, even in the research, to read about one or the other only.
Right, because I have very strong positive feelings about having it used for medical purposes. Just in general use, like we have alcohol or tobacco, I don't know enough to say, and also I noticed that we frequently think of children And I don't know why it, like alcohol, couldn't be limited to adults. But it is interesting that we have a tolerance for tobacco and alcohol, which we know is a poison and addictive. And yet when it comes to marijuana, we single it out. We know we don't even look at that. I've got my thoughts mixed up. But anyway, I read this theory once that the reason we have such problems and controversy with marijuana is that it is more associated with the counterculture, which is negative to a lot of people, whereas if you poison yourself with tobacco or alcohol, that's more conventional. It's more acceptable to people because of that. Just a thought.
All right. Thank you, Jane. Thanks for the call. We appreciate the thought. And Dr. Quill, she's talking about some of the things that you've been talking about, that you've been using the word social change and those kinds of terms, even in this medical discussion.
Yeah, I think the more that the use, at least initially, could be restricted to people with serious illness, I think we're on safer ground then. But again, if you start talking about chronic pain, what is an example of what some people might call a slippery slope? How much pain is chronic pain? How many people in the general population have back aches or neck aches? And are they going to be excluded or included? So once you start to really look at how do you regulate these things, it becomes very hard to find the boundaries.
All right, you can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP, stands for Second Opinion 2NDOP, and we'll get the questions to Dr. Quill, and he can answer them or make comments. Let's stay with the telephones now. Jenna's been waiting. Thanks very much, Jenna, for waiting. Go right ahead.
I think a couple of points need to be made. One is, you know, we didn't always know that cigarettes were dangerous until we uncovered the nasty little memos. It used to be prescribed for weight loss by doctors and physicians. With medical marijuana and families considering it for their children, we're typically talking about children who suffer from catastrophic epilepsy, et cetera, for whom this is the only, maybe not proven, but even anecdotal, evidence of proven treatment. I have a friend with a 9-year-old son, and the only thing that has helped is the medical marijuana oil. Whether or not it causes cognitive delays, we're beyond that point. So do so many of the drugs, including the FDA just issued a warning about Miralax, the laxative. So I think we need to be more honest about the conversation and the effects, the positive effects of medical marijuana, the oil, has been proven to have for children.
All right. Thanks for the comment. Jenna, do you want to respond to that, Dr. Quill?
Yeah.
You've been talking about serious illness.
I think if you have kids with extremely serious illness, like difficult to control epilepsy, then absolutely you're going to turn every stone you can to try to find something that will work. And if marijuana might work, absolutely try it. I think if you could limit it to those kinds of cases, I'm totally for it. I think broader issues of treating other childhood illnesses with marijuana, I think, boy, we better take a careful look at that. But for the more extreme circumstances where we don't have a lot of good options, then I think it's reasonable to think about that.
All right, let's stay with the telephones now. John, thank you very much for waiting. I'm sorry that I went by your line, but you've been sitting
yes.
there on the line for quite a while. Go right ahead.
Yes. Is it Dr. Quill?
Yes, Dr.
Yes,
Quill.
Doctor. There's a political and a medical component to this. Legalization of marijuana. How could it be with what's wrong with patient-driven use of medical marijuana? And with so many states wanting to do it, the federal government says no. And in light of that, the use of opioids or painkillers are pharmaceutical or medical establishment-driven. And they've become a huge problem. And so how could it be that, you know, on the, you know, grassroots on the streets, you know, maybe unresearched but still anecdotal, how could that be wrong? I mean, with all the people that have benefited from it and the misinformation that's put out by the government and some the medical establishment, I mean,
okay, Dr. Quill, looks like we may have lost John, but maybe you could respond to what he said so far.
Well, I think, you know, it's we've known with alcohol and other things that there, you know, there's a lot of use. It can be used recreationally. Most people can use it well. There are people who have difficulty with it. I think prohibition absolutely of alcohol was a failure. Probably prohibition absolutely of marijuana is also a failure. But I do think if we are going to think about legalizing this, we need to open our eyes that there are risks involved in this, and the risks are real. And it may be that adults can take risks. They should be given the opportunity to take those risks. Certainly a libertarian would say that's the way we ought to go. But there are real risks here, and we just have to acknowledge that.
You're listening to Healthy Friday on WXXI and WEOS, and you're watching Second Opinion Live on secondopinion-tv.org. Our guest in the studio today is Dr. Timothy Quill. He's a professor of medicine, psychiatry, and medical humanities in the palliative care division at the Department of Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Quill, is there research being done at URMC in terms of efficacy or other things related to medical marijuana right now?
I don't think there might be a little bit going on, but we're certainly watching the process of the legislature figuring out what the regulations are going to look like. We're certainly hoping that there's going to be funds allocated to study this so that we can really find out more about how it works and in what populations it works.
What's your understanding of the legislation right now?
I think it's very freshly done.
This is the New York State legislation.
Mm-hmm. Very freshly done, just on the broad strokes. But I think it's going to take them a while to work out the details of what conditions. They're talking about a registration process. They're talking about some training of physicians and prescribing. They're talking about the kinds of forms they're going to do, the limits per dose, who can handle these things. So there's a lot of nuts and bolts that have to be worked out, that have been worked out in other states in very different ways. So I think they want to take a look at what's done in other states. But I think in the next year and a half, they will work through that, and then we'll see what they come up with. Knowing New York, it will be complex and probably fairly comprehensive relative to other states.
It's a little bit different than other states, what we're doing in New York.
It is. The restricting it to not smoking it,
right,
is an interesting restriction, because we do know that smoked chemicals generally are not good for the body. So in that sense, that was a smart restriction, even though the volume of smoke in marijuana compared to the volume people usually smoke in cigarettes is much less, but we don't really know all what's in marijuana a lot of the time. So you're putting some smoked stuff into your lungs. It probably is not good. So I think that was a reasonably a wise limitation from a medical point of view.
But there are others that say that it was not a good limitation, that it won't be as effective without being able to be smoked, that other forms won't work as well. So there are even controversy related to that piece of the New York State legislation.
Right, but there's no data to
right.
support that. These are how people feel about it. But the vaporized should be similar way of delivering without the same toxicity potentially to the lungs.
All right, we're talking with Dr. Timothy Quill today on Healthy Friday and on Second Opinion Live. You are welcome to tweet us with your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. We would love to hear from you. And you can call us at 844-295-8255, 295-TALK, to talk about medical marijuana. You know, Dr. Quill, as we talk about this the substance marijuana, and we talk about research efficacy, I've interviewed a lot of doctors, and I feel like I'm having a conversation with a doctor almost about supplements when I hear things like evidence-based and any organic materials. When we speak to physicians who really believe in the evidence-based piece of this, it's a similar conversation, it seems to me, that we're having about an organic substance being used for medicinal purposes. Is it similar, do you think?
There's a lot of similarity. I think many Western trained physicians are very wary about supplements because there's no evidence base, or when you do subject them to the usual studies that we like to subject drugs to, they don't show efficacy. And marijuana would be in that group, although I think it can be studied and should be studied because it probably will have some efficacy in certain populations.
As a palliative care physician, somebody who's been in that world for a very long time, do you see marijuana as affecting your practice? I heard you say a little earlier that you might not, that it might be a second line or third line type of prescription. Do you see this as having an impact?
Well, I think the impact is going to be that the range of conditions they're talking about are very broad, and each of them, particularly the chronic pain world, is a very broad world. So it's, you know, there's a lot of the population that has some chronic pain, and trying to evaluate all such patients for medical marijuana, I think, is a potentially big job. So I think somebody who's certified is going to have to be able to allow that prescription, which what we see in places like Colorado, where when it was legalized, that a relatively small number of physicians did the vast majority of the prescriptions, so that they became, for lack of a better word, prescribing mills. You go to this doctor with your pain, you know you can get a prescription for marijuana. And that may well be what happens in New York as well, because the potential number of patients who may want this is going to be very large, and the number of people who are really trained to evaluate such patients. And the evaluation is not clear what kind of chronic pain. What do you have to have tried other things? How many other things? There's no criteria like that.
So there are no criteria. I was going to ask you, you know, what is the criteria? What's the process? There is not one yet. Is that up to the individual physician then at this point, or it just has not been laid out for physicians?
It's going to be hard to lay out clear criteria within the world of chronic pain for using. Do you have to have tried certain things? Which things? How many? How often? How many times? I can't imagine the legislature getting into that level of detail.
You know, as we listened to Jenna a few minutes ago, and as we've read some of the stories about families dealing with epilepsy or very serious illness, and we talk about palliative care, it makes me feel as though some of these people have used just about everything they can use. They're trying to deal as best they can.
Yeah.
What does this conversation say to you about palliative care in general, about the way that we deal with pain in this country, about the way that we understand palliative care? We feel maybe like we've come a long way, but what does this conversation, this interest in marijuana, say to you about that?
Well, I think it's somewhat similar to the palliative care conversation, and that is the more medical marijuana is being requested by people with extremely serious illness, potentially life-threatening illness, who have tried the usual treatments, the easier the conversation is. I don't think there's a huge debate. I don't think there's going to be a lot of reluctance to prescribe to such persons. The more people are generally healthy, the more they are young, the more they have other risk factors like a history of alcoholism or substance abuse, the more we ought to be really cautious. Because I do think in that population, that's where the risk is, the bulk of the risk is.
All right. Our telephone number is 844-295-8255, 844-295-8255. That stands for TALK, 295-TALK. And you can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. We're talking to Dr. Timothy Quill today about medical marijuana. Dr. Quill, we've been talking about research. The issue of research has come up over and over again, especially in New York State, now that there's legislation in other states. And you've said that might be one of the upsides to this, that we can do research. Will you explain again why it will be difficult to do research? What will be the obstacles, and what will be what do you hope to get from research? But why will it be difficult to do research?
Well, one of the reasons is that the number of actual chemicals and variants of what goes under the world in the world of marijuana is very large. So if you prove it with one strain of marijuana, does that mean the other 99 strains are also going to work, or is it just that one strain? And it's very hard to purify that one strain. So can you reproduce it if it's a grown plant? So there's a lot of I think technical parts of the research that are going to be very complex when you do these kinds of research.
Is that similar to, say, like a flu vaccination, where it's hard to figure out what it is that you should use or make in order to address one kind of flu, or is it not like that?
It's not really like that.
Okay.
With flu, you know there are different pieces of the whatever you're trying to recreate. There might be five pieces, and you can vary each of those pieces, and then you can study them, and then you can try to predict what that might do. Here there's lots of pieces and lots of delivery systems, and we're not sure what the critical pieces are at all, and so it's much harder to study
All right. And there will have to be federally approved supplies of marijuana in order to be studied? Is that
I don't think the federal government is not going to be part of this,
okay,
because the federal government still prohibits, under the Controlled Substances Act, marijuana. So if you have medicinal marijuana, you can't carry it from New York to a state that doesn't have it.
Right.
That will be still illegal there.
All right, our phone number again. We have about 10 minutes left in our conversation. So if you have a question or a comment about medical marijuana, you can call us at 844-295-TALK, 295-8255. We're also taking questions at the hashtag 2NDOP on Twitter. Let's take a telephone call now. Maggie's on the line from Canandaigua. Thanks very much for calling, Maggie. Did you have a question?
I have a comment, if that's okay.
Certainly, go
what
right ahead.
What I would like to say is that I have been sober for 25 years and heard thousands of stories from addicts and alcoholics, and every single one I believe that I have almost ever heard started with marijuana and then went on to additional drugs. The marijuana released their inhibitions, and once they were in with that part of the crowd that used the marijuana, the crowd again exposed them to additional drugs and/or alcohol. So I am extremely against the casual use of any drug like marijuana that would encourage additional addiction.
Okay, thanks for the comment, Maggie. I appreciate it.
No, I think that's well said. I think if you're in a if you have a personal history of alcoholism or any kind of drug abuse, then marijuana is not the right thing for you to be using, even if it was widely available and legalized. Just like alcohol is not the right thing to do, even though it's widely available and legalized. I think as you get to family history of these things, how strong is that family history? If it's really strong, you're rolling the dice when you start to play with these drugs, because if you're at risk, just like if you started to drink heavily, so I think these are serious decisions to be made, and the risks are very real, and particularly real if you have genetics or family history.
And as a physician, I'm going to assume that our physicians are not going to just cavalierly prescribe this. You're going to take a family history, right? You're going to understand the patient. So if I'm a patient who wants medical marijuana or who is talking to you about it, you're going to go through the same process that you would if you were putting me on a statin, correct?
Well, I think in the ideal world, yes. In the ideal world, if you see your doctor and you're requesting this, they're going to do a very careful evaluation, and they're going to talk very seriously about the risks and benefits in your particular case. But again, if you look to Colorado, where, 15 doctors do half of the prescribing for the whole state, they are not doing a family history. They are doing, do you want medical marijuana? Yeah, here's a prescription. And collecting whatever assessment fee there is, and that's going to be perfectly legal. So I think that's the challenge that's going to be out there. You will be able to get access without that careful evaluation if you really want it.
All right, we're talking with Dr. Timothy Quill. We have lots of tweets and questions on the telephone lines. Let's go to line two now. Tom's on the line from Fairport. Go right ahead, Tom, if you have a question or a comment.
Yes, I think that the proposed law of requiring the medical marijuana not to be smoked but to be consumed by the vaporized oil is a problem, because there's going to be a substance out there that'll be very readily abused, be able to be taken in much larger quantities, in the same way that addicts learned that they could crush the OxyContin tablets. And I think that there's a real potential abuse problem out there. In addition, I guess I'd like to have some understanding of what the concept of psychological dependency is. Right now, I don't feel very sympathetic to the notion that somebody can be psychological dependent, although I do understand a physical dependency.
All right, go ahead. Why don't you respond to Tom in terms of the physical dependence or psychological dependence question?
Physical dependency would be that if you stop using it, you will have withdrawal symptoms. So, for example, anybody on long-standing opioid pain medicine, even if they're not addicted to it, if they're on it for a very good reason, if they stop it suddenly, they will have withdrawal symptoms. That's physical dependence. It has nothing to do with addiction. It has nothing to do with psychological dependence. Psychological dependences would be that when you don't use it, you are looking for, it's not a physical craving, but psychologically you're craving to find the next one. You're looking for where you're going to get your next dose or whatever. And psychological dependence on marijuana, I think, is in many people becomes an issue. And it's particularly people with this family history of addiction and or alcoholism.
All right, we have about 30 seconds left, Dr. Quill. Let's take our last tweet. This tweet says, "Our academic medical center is eager to do this research, even though it's challenging. Are you and your colleagues or medical centers that you know of, would you like to get more involved in research into this?"
I think we're eager to do the research. Yeah, I think the research needs to be done. I think this wave is happening. I think the more we can understand and get some better evidence to decide who can benefit, where the risks are, the better off we're going to be. So I think we're very excited about that piece.
All right, Dr. Timothy Quill, thanks very much for your time today.
It's my pleasure.
We appreciate it. That's all the time we have for Healthy Friday and for Second Opinion Live. We want to thank you very much for listening, for your tweets and your calls and your questions and your comments. Thank you to our sponsor, too, the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. Their support helped make this program possible. And thanks to all of you listening on WXXI 1370 on WEOS and watching on secondopinion-tv.org. One reminder, this program offers medical information, not medical advice. If you have a healthcare concern, please see your health care provider. I'm Elisa Orlando. We'll be back here for another Healthy Friday and a Second Opinion Live on Friday, August 15th. We look forward to hearing from you then.